Okay, so thanks again to Jeff for the invitation following last year's conference at Manchester Met, and also thank you to Max for getting us set up and to the wider BSSH for facilitating today's session and for organising travel and logistics. So it's great to be able to present here in London. It's a city that's got a very specific connection to Walford, and that's something that I'll touch on as we progress through the presentation. So the first slide helpfully shows an image of the front cover of my book that kind of grew organically out of the research process. The title of my PhD is shown on screen as well. So the title of the more academic text was Faith, Community and Football, The Life of Brother Walford. And the book, I would suggest, is a more, or hopefully a more readable account of my 5 years worth of research at the University of Stirling. But it's the same themes we're going to be focusing on tonight, on community, faith and football. And it's through a biographical study of the leading founder of Celtic FC, Brother Walford. So I drew on the literature that surrounds historical biography in an academic context. So we know that it's an emerging field, especially as regards sport research. And it was Michael Erben, an American sociologist, who explains that through the prism of an individual life, you can begin to interrogate the impact of societal factors. So Walford was born Andrew Cairns, and he was a survivor of the period known as the Great Hunger, or An Gortar Mór in Irish. So that was a real formative event in his life. And it's something that impacted, of course, on his personal character, which is the other aspect that Erben focuses on. So we know that he was a spiritual person. He devoted his adult life to religion through his service as a Catholic educator with the Maris brothers. And he had a real passion for charity, for organising fundraising drives, and through the creation of Celtic, of course. He's left a huge legacy in that regard. So I'm going to focus, these are a synthesised version of my research question. So I'm going to really focus on the who, the what and the why with this presentation. So who was Walford? What did he achieve? And finally, we'll touch on why does he matter today for so many? So Brother Walford was a Maris brother, as I touched on before, which means he devoted his life to Catholic education. And I've just looked out a short kind of excerpt from the book that quite helpfully explains exactly who we're speaking of, because I know that a few of you won't know who Brother Walford was. I'm hoping the majority will have heard of Celtic Football Club. But just by way of introduction or setting the scene, so Andrew Cairns, as he was born and became Brother Walford after he became a Maris brother, was one of the most significant Irish immigrants to Scotland. An individual outstanding in relation to Catholic education and charity in Glasgow, and a major contributor to the emergence of organised sport in the late 19th century. So Cairns, or Walford, was but one individual amongst countless thousands of victims who survived the catastrophe of An Gortar Mór in Ireland, only to be forced to leave behind family, community and homeland in the hope of finding a better life overseas. Over 1 million others perished owing to the prevalence of starvation and disease during Ireland's darkest period. So Walford left Glasgow as a 15-year-old boy, and that spectre of hunger, accompanied by a concern for the spiritual and physical well-being of others, particularly the most disadvantaged children in the communities, the various communities that he worked amongst, These are motifs which endured throughout his long and impactful life. So Walfrid lived a long and impactful life to the grand old age of 74. But the period that we're going to focus on, or the chapter of my book, is just a short five-year connection with Celtic Football Club, which is surprising to many because he's almost always immediately associated with the famous football club in Glasgow. But it's only a five-year chapter of his 74 years. So Walfrid's achievements in life reflect his origins in famished Ireland, as well as the three major themes that we're going to touch on, which motivated his memorable actions in life thereafter, namely his Catholic faith, community-based charitable action, alongside a close and enduring association with football, and of course Celtic Football Club in particular. He played a leading role in founding Celtic in order to support the impoverished Irish Catholic diaspora in Glasgow. So the meaningfulness of the club with regard to its historic supporting community has been analysed by other historians and sociologists in a modern context. A fuller consideration of the exact role and function Brother Walfrid performed in those embryonic stages of Celtic's existence, however, has not been achieved, I would suggest, until now. The period between the founding of Celtic FC in 1887 and Walfrid's departure for London has been reappraised and sheds new light on the understanding of the totemic role he played. So I'll just move my slides on to focus on that motif of charity. And we're going to focus on how charity manifested through the organisation of Celtic Football Club. So the Walfrid name is indelibly associated with and most often recognised in relation to his leading role in the founding of Celtic Football Club, under the greater purpose of fundraising for charitable purposes. So his position and legacy within the club's history, along with his individual influence on the formation and first years of operation of the club, are assured. Alongside his role as headmaster of the Sacred Heart School, his connection with Celtic FC played out entirely in conjunction with his vocation as a senior Marist brother, and indeed was an extension of it. Francis O'Hagan explains that the approach of the Marist brothers to Christian charity was strongly based on community effort and sought to be practical and interventionist in its missionary application. In this vein, the charitable origins of Celtic FC can be traced back to the religious influence of the Marist ethos and an extension of the vow of poverty taken by its founder, Brother Walfrid. So football enjoyed an increasingly prominent position in Scottish life as both the most popular spectator game as well as the most widely practised or played sport by the late 19th century. And this opportunity was noted by Brother Walfrid. He was the superior of the Marist community close to Glasgow Green, and he envisaged the prospect of harnessing the potential of Glasgow's Irish Catholic diaspora through the vehicle of a football club. This had been achieved by friends in Edinburgh with Hibernian FC, which arose out of the concentration of Irish immigrants, chiefly in the areas of the Cowgate and Old Town of Scotland's capital. And indeed, it was Hibs who won the Scottish Cup of 1887, just a few short months before Walfrid decided to go and do likewise. So this endeavour for Walfrid could in turn provide monies which could be used charitably to improve the situation of the neediest members of his own community, particularly the children of St Mary's, Sacred Heart and St Michael's parish schools, which were then ran by the Marist brothers. So that founding principle to provide for the poor children of the East End is made explicit in the circular heralding the creation of Celtic FC back in January 1888. It's a written statement which bears all the hallmarks of Walfrid's tone and style of writing. It requests for volunteer labourers, illustrating the implicit centrality of community building to the Celtic project from its inception. Morris was led to conclude that such voluntary Catholic charity can be viewed as part of a distinct network of similarly organised initiatives, including children's refuge homes and industrial schools, which also sprang up in Victorian Glasgow. In this sense, the early charity of Celtic FC was part of a wider progressive philanthropic movement among the largest immigrant community in the city at that particular time. It allowed Irish Catholics to take pride in the achievements of the group. So both Matt McDowell and Neil Tranter agree that the early patrons and administrators of football clubs in Scotland were aware of this wider potential of Scotland's working class pastime as a vehicle for socialisation and philanthropy. Walfred himself had tapped into the original spirit of folks football that McDowell speaks about, which endured from the first half of the 19th century. He did this by introducing a football to the pupils of Glasgow schools opened by the Marist Brothers in the city following Angotamore, or the famine period and the influx of immigrants that brought. In Glasgow especially, football captured the imagination of the paying and playing public like no other sport. McDowell finds, and I quote, "Within the space of 25 years in the late 19th century, football went from being perceived as a gentleman's amusement to becoming a booming entertainment trade that inspired the working class to take up its practice." End quote. Tranter, on the other hand, traces a dramatic rise in interest surrounding the sport from the 1867 establishment of Scotland's first association football club, Queen's Park of Glasgow, right up until 1906, so less than 40 years later, the number of clubs had risen from 1 to 116, the majority of which were based in Glasgow or the surrounding West Central Belt. Tranter explains that leading figures at football clubs during the period sought to evoke a sense of community identity to supplement the physical side of the activity. So Celtic was born out of the immigrant community in Glasgow to which Brother Walfred belonged, and came to symbolise a club sympathetic to the needs of its community. The role of Walfred in the creation of a charitable sporting organisation has been seen as part of a wider Catholic programme in Glasgow to emulate social welfare networks during the Depression of the 1880s. The club's community origins gave rise to its enduring association with Irishness, Catholicism and charity. And Brother Walfred himself, at 47 years of age at the club's inception, was the eldest of a group of Irish Catholic individuals identified as playing key roles in establishing Celtic in its earliest amateur phase. So Brendan Sweeney, who has authored Celtic the Early Years, highlights an article that appeared in 1893 in the Glasgow Observer, and it was penned by a vocal Irish nationalist writer, John McAdam, who was indeed a former pupil of Walfred at St Mungo's in Glasgow in the 1860s. McAdam went on to find his vocation back in Ireland, founding and editing newspapers supportive of Michael Davitt's Land League movement, a cause that was closely associated with the early charitable giving of Celtic FC. Writing from Donegal, McAdam recalls with fondness those days when we sat in front of the well-polished desks under the tuition of dear, quick-tempered, lovable Brother Walfred. In his article, which was titled Reminiscence of St Mungo's Academy, McAdam goes on to mention notable classmates, enabling Sweeney to conclude that Brother Walfred taught other founding fathers such as Joseph Nellis, Michael Cairns, Joseph McGrory, John McCready, and Dr. John Conway, some of the most closely associated individuals, along with Walfred, surrounding the foundation of Celtic FC. Indeed, both Nellis and Conway feature in a July 1867 annual exhibition and prize-giving report from St Mungo's, while Walfred was a teacher there. Their roles in performance of the Lady of the Lake and Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, respectively, gained merited applause. McAdam's reminiscence concludes, and I quote, "Bless them all, and bless the good brothers and their noble work. Someday I will go and see them and ask permission to sit at the desk and write upon an exercise. Perhaps I could live it all over again, if only Brother Walfred could be induced to come cautiously behind in the way I remember so well, and with an accompanying slap behind the ear, say, 'Hold your pen straight.' I might eagerly welcome that." End quote. So Mannion highlights the role of missing men in terms of educators like Brother Walfred and their impact on early association football. Brother Walfred clearly represented a memorable and influential figure in the lives of those former pupils who went on to relative success in Glasgow. Young men schooled in the Marist ethos who answered Walfred's call as he sought to organise a football club formed in that spirit of Christian charity. The call was also answered by individuals who worked on the construction of the first incarnation of Celtic Park in the winter of 1887 into the spring of 88. Tom Campbell and Pat Woods consider the religious influence of at the foundation of the club, stating, and I quote, "It was manifestly clear that Celtic was a Catholic club," end quote, with Charles Eyre, the Archbishop of Glasgow, becoming the first honorary patron. Reports from the Glasgow Observer show that senior figures from the Catholic Church were indeed present at Celtic's first fixture, which took place after completion of the stadium on 28th of May 1888. And I have to point this detail out. It was a victory against City rivals Rangers at Celtic Park. Campbell and Woods discussed the notion that by funding a school feeding programme, Brother Walfred and the founders of the club were seeking to reaffirm the faith and identity of Glasgow's impoverished Catholic community by providing an alternative to Protestant missionary soup kitchens. Joe Bradley, who supervised my PhD project at the University of Stirling, explains that, and I quote, "Celtic were then founded by and for Irish Catholics, though never exclusively so," end quote. Absolute poverty, lack of access to education, and anti-Catholic discrimination relegated Glasgow's Irish Catholic immigrant community to a disadvantaged social position from the outset. Walfred's legacy of Celtic FC came to represent and continues to represent a beacon of hope, both in terms of strengthening the communal identity of Glasgow's multi-generational Irish, as well as by providing for that community through the proliferation of an enduring ethos of charity. The Glasgow Charity Cup, for example, only began to include Catholic charitable causes in its list of beneficiaries after Celtic first entered the tournament in 1888. Bradley reinforces this view in concluding, and I quote, "The club came into existence as the focus for much Catholic and Irish community activity, a setting for that community's broad social and political aspirations," end quote. And I would just add to that, it's perhaps comparable to FC Barcelona in Catalonia and the fact that the stadium there was a safe haven for Catalan speakers in that part of Spain. So for the purpose of analysis, the first phase of Celtic's early development for this presentation is dated from its founding in November 87 until the professionalisation of Scottish football in 1893. It was during these years that Walfred, for the most part, was the senior Marist in Glasgow, and it was during this short chapter of his life that he was most closely associated with the club that he's became known as the founding father of. Campbell and Woods agree that the distribution of of funds to local Catholic charities fostered pride within Glasgow's Irish community. They also voice a word of caution in that the move to professionalisation during the 1890s meant that, and I quote, "change was inevitable and natural in their view." So Willie Maley, was one of the original Celtic players who made up the first 11, who played the first game of the club's history. And indeed, he became the club's first manager after incorporation of the club into a business just 10 short years after its foundation. He later wrote that, and I quote, "The period at the start of the club was what is now known as the day of the paid amateur," end quote. So the uncertainty brought about shamateurism, as it became known, caused much internal strife and soul searching within the club, as reported by contemporary newspapers. Additionally, some have suggested that Brother Walford's departure from Glasgow to London in the summer of 1892 marked a major turning point in the outlook of Celtic in terms of its commitment to charity. Additionally, the move to a larger, more modern stadium in 1892 has also been viewed as indicative of the Celtic Committee's commercial plans for the club post-Walford. However, newspaper reportage of the time, coupled with a closer analysis of donations facilitated by the St Vincent de Paul Society in particular, helped to shed new light on the extent and nature of the charitable activity of Celtic FC during these years. The club's early involvement in the Glasgow Charity Cup and hosting of annual sports day competitions provides further significant examples of the positive impact of the club on the wider city. But the reality was that Celtic's relationship with its original ideals, as set out by Walford, was a complex one, influenced by several internal and external factors. So Willie Maley, who we mentioned, his Jubilee History of Celtic charts the early development of the club from its birth in 87 until 1938, arguably offering the most comprehensive of all contemporary accounts available of the first decades of its progress. He describes the factors which shaped the club in its early phase and places the era of Scottish football in context, as Celtic rapidly grew from humble origins in the amateur age. Maley's book represents a rare account of the period. His was one of only a few histories of football clubs produced in the United Kingdom before World War II. And as a former Celtic player, secretary and manager from 1887 until 1940, Maley offers almost half a century's worth of unique insight into the club's inner workings at all levels from its earliest days. The individuality of the source, as always, is tempered by the fact that as a official history commissioned by the club, it is therefore likely to be less critical of positions and policies adopted by Celtic. The book is designed to appeal to Celtic supporters, and as an employee of the organisation, Maley's sources could be accused of originating from a biased perspective. Nevertheless, the possibility of bias is countered by the first-hand experience recorded by Maley and makes for an important contemporary source which allows for informed conclusions to be drawn on that early period. Excuse me. So Maley acclaimed the role of Walford when reflecting later in an article titled Celtic Memories in Retirement, and describes the Marist brother as, I quote, "the guide, philosopher and friend of the movement behind the club's foundation." He wrote, and I quote again, "the formation of the new club found in him the right man for the job, and by his efforts he found the cash and personal assistance who actually laid down Celtic Park, the stadium, by hard work after their ordinary work was done." Another Marist brother, James Handley, or Brother Clare, built on Maley's contribution in his spare time by producing another bespoke history of Celtic in 1960, so a couple of decades on from Maley's history. The Glasgow-based Marist brother found that, I quote, "from its foundation, the Celtic Club has been closely associated with Ireland and Catholicism. It was called into being to provide money for Catholic charities," end quote. Handley wrote extensively on the background and impact of Irish immigration to Scotland during the 19th century in his career as a published historian, alongside his role as head teacher of various schools in Scotland. Born in County Cavan, he shares similar roots and upbringing to Walfrid himself. And there's every chance that the two men met in 1912, the same year that Brother Walfrid retired to the Dumfries Novitiate that James Handley was taking his lessons as a Marist brother. So Handley's record shows that much of Celtic's original financial records, minutes and photographs were lost as the result of a 1929 fire in the pavilion of the Celtic Park Stadium. Contemporary newspaper reports, he suggests, should be relied on to form the basis for work on this period of the club's history. Again, given the religious background of Handley and his position within the Marist Brothers Institute in Scotland, his work provides a significant insight into the spiritual origins of the club and that charitable ethos instilled at its birth by Brother Walfrid. So to summarise, the works of both Mailey and Handley are central to understanding the early history of Celtic Football Club. So in my view, Brother Walfrid sought to fuse the Victorian fascination with football together with the ideals of charity and community that were central to his own faith. It was in this spirit that Walfrid held that meeting at the League of the Cross Hall, a temperance hall, ironically, in the St Mary's parish of the Calton in Glasgow, to formally constitute the club on the 6th of November 1887. So to this day, an annual anniversary mass is celebrated in that same Catholic church. Indeed, Brother Walfrid had previously had connections with football. We know that he introduced the football to pupils of the Marist Brothers. He also organised charity matches played in the shadow of his Sacred Heart School in the Bridgeton district of Glasgow. He famously invited Hibs from Edinburgh to play on ground owned by the influential Monteith family of Catholic benefactors in Glasgow for a hugely successful charity match against Clyde FC in 1886 before the arrival of Celtic. The attendance is recorded by various newspapers as being comparable to the attendance at the 1886 Scottish Cup final, and this is for a charity match, so the appetite was huge for a club to arrive in Glasgow to represent these people. And Walfrid also counted on the support of his fellow Marist brother, Dorotheus, who, coming from Dundee, had contacts with Dundee Harp, for example, another identifiably Irish team that were invited through for successful fundraising matches. He'd also organised a junior Sacred Heart parish team by the name of Eastern Rovers, and I quote the Glasgow Observer, which had been raised through the exertions of Brother Walfrid, end quote. So football was evidently a sport which captured the imagination of Walfrid, as well as the Marist brothers generally, over the course of his years in Glasgow. His Marist colleague, long-serving headmaster in Glasgow, a Frenchman, Brother Ezekiel, who was born in 1856, so slightly younger than Walfrid. His full name was Edmund Luke de Koopman, and he's credited with suggesting the name of Celtic for the football club to Brother Walfrid. The Scottish Umpire sports paper carries the first mention of Celtic in print, and I quote, "We learn that the efforts which have been lately made to organise in Glasgow a first-class Catholic football club have been successfully consummated by the formation of the Glasgow Celtic Football and Athletic Club," end quote. So Handley characterised the mission of the brothers in the city, led by Walfrid at this time, remember, as one primarily geared towards providing for the welfare of children, or school children, in particular of Irish immigrants, who comprised the vast bulk of the Catholic population. In the circular that was most likely drafted by Walfrid, dispersed to Catholic parishes in Glasgow to herald the arrival or creation of a football club, it states, and I quote, The main object of the club is to supply the East End conferences of the St Vincent de Paul Society with the funds for the maintenance of the dinner tables of our needy children. This was a school feeding programme created by Brother Wilfrid along with Dorotheus back in 1884, and it was rolled out to three parish schools which comprised the St Mary's Deanery, located in the eastern districts of Glasgow. These were St Mary's, St Michael's and Wilfrid's own Sacred Heart School. The penny dinner scheme was first trialled by the brothers at St Mary's School, then it had the largest roll of pupils of all the Maris Brothers schools in Glasgow, before being replicated at Sacred Heart and St Michael's, which is the school closest to the club stadium to this day. So Wilfrid himself explained that the penny was only charged when no hardship was involved to preserve the self-respect of the beneficiaries. Dignity, so that idea surrounding of human dignity. Delivery of the charity that was carried out on behalf of the football club. The Celtic FC committee was able to provide over £400, which is in excess of £50,000 in terms of today's values, to the local branches mentioned in association with the St Vincent de Paul charity through match ticket sales in the club's first season of 1888 and 89. So again, there's huge support and a huge appetite for sporting charity in Glasgow at this time. This perhaps partly explains the club's initial success on the field. It reached the Scottish Cup final of 1887-88. Wasn't quite successful, but they did indeed win the Scottish League Championship just four seasons after the club's creation, and assumed a position of prominence within Scottish football almost immediately. Ray Vanplew states that in the Victorian era, relatively little money went to charity directly from football club accounts, on average much less than 1% of net profits. During this chapter of Wilfrid's connection with Celtic Football Club, Celtic proved to be an exception to this rule. Celtic's first balance sheet, signed off by the Maris brother Dorotheus, was published accompanied by a circular written by the club's honorary secretary and called the first annual general meeting to announce those figures, appoint office bearers and discuss wider club affairs. The treasurer, John Herbert McLaughlin, who was a very influential figure in the professionalisation of Scottish football, states in his report that just over £420 was donated to 14 different charitable causes from an expenditure of over £3,800. So the St Vincent de Paul Society and school children's dinner tables was the biggest recipient, as you can imagine. However, the report also demonstrates that Celtic's charity was not purely confined to Catholic or Irish organisations. £10 was donated to the Handloom Weavers of Bridgeton, the part of the city where Wilfrid was engaged in his daily headmaster duties. So by donating to non-denominational causes in Glasgow, it is clear that Celtic's charity was quickly able to supersede its original stated aim of helping poor Irish Catholic children in the East End. Moreover, the fact that the club reported committing 11% of its expenditure to charity, far in excess of the 1% commonly seen elsewhere, shows that Celtic FC was able to surpass that general level of donation compared to any other football club based in the United Kingdom at that time. So I'm going to quote some more newspaper reports of further annual meetings. So in 1890, the committee were again keen to draw special attention to the charity donations of the club. This time, the Scottish Port reports donations increased to £500. Brother Wilfrid's own favoured poor children's dinner table scheme continued to be the leading recipient, receiving 160 of those £500. However, the sport goes on to again stress the diversity of Celtic's charity. So £20, for example, was given to the Greenhead Disaster Fund for the families of 29 women who lost their lives when part of the Templeton's carpet manufacturing factory collapsed close to Glasgow Green, where Brother Walfred and the Maris brothers were based in the city. So this further illustrates the practice of not restricting charitable donations to purely Irish Catholic causes. The club's scope had now surpassed its east end of Glasgow roots, with donations extending to Edinburgh charities, while aid offered to the Irish Land League movement of Michael David, who was made an honorary patron of the club in 1893, exhibited an international link back to the island of Ireland, home to Brother Walfred and the vast majority of Celtic's generational support. At this embryonic stage in the club's history, the sport was able to report or conclude, and I quote, that Celtic, we may add, has given in charity more than all of the other football clubs of Glasgow, end quote. The Glasgow Herald in 1890 reports on how Celtic FC began to gain prominence in terms of a wider Christian philanthropic movement of the Victorian era at a civic level, while also retaining the faith and cultural values of its own distinct commonality. The report provides an account of the opening of the Catholic Children's Refuge at Whitevale, again in the east end of the city. Celtic had provided a £70 donation towards the establishment of the children's shelter. The involvement of Walfred Sporting Club in the Whitevale project represents a fulfilment of its stated founding obligation to aid the needy children of the predominantly Irish Catholic population of the East End. So one of the senior clergy who was present at the opening of the refuge gave an address emphasising the fact that the Catholic community remained in its relative infancy in the city post-Reformation in Scotland, and alluded to the poverty, discrimination and lack of education suffered by the immigrant Irish who had bolstered that community in Glasgow. And I quote, after they had been driven from their own country by the calamities which had fallen upon it. The quote continues, charity and care of the poor and of the young was an absolute doctrine in the Catholic Church, end quote. And the opening of the refuge is heralded by the newspaper as a sign of the continued advancement of the Irish Catholic community in a wider sense. A civic judge, so a non-Catholic present at the event, commented that, and I quote, irrespective of denomination, the magistrates of Glasgow were very glad to see institutions such as this, which they regarded as necessities for the community life of the city at large. So the charitable function of Celtic FC has occurred as part of a wider philanthropic effort on behalf of the Irish Catholic community to take steps to improve the lot of its most vulnerable members. The education of the Maris brothers, including Walfred's penny dinner scheme, can be seen in this light. They can also be understood as a forerunner of free school meals and were a successful means of increasing attendance at these schools in the east end of Glasgow. Commenting on the origins of Celtic back in 1888, the Scottish referee reflects that, and I quote, the club had a phoenix-like origin. It arose from the fading ashes of many other organisations within Glasgow's Irish Catholic community, end quote. So Brother Walfred's leading role in the foundation can be understood as one of chief organiser. He was able to bring together disparate elements of that community, senior clergy, Irish nationalist political figures and more business-minded individuals under a common banner of sporting charity. Brother Walfred's will to live out his vow of poverty, and I've included in the slide a stained glass window which goes a long way to emblifying the vow of poverty that each Marist brother is called on to devote his life to. So that vow of poverty found expression through the club and its charitable values, which in turn brought goodwill and support from within the Catholic community from which it was founded, but also garnering support across civic society and the Scottish sporting press. Handley finds later in London that Brother Walfrid continued his school charities in St Anne's Whitechapel, end quote, where he resided for most of his years in England. He was in St Anne's for nearly 20 years. Although the Glasgow Observer states in Walfrid's obituary that he never lost interest in the doing of the Celts, although the loss of his influential presence and charitable conscience he imbued the club with at birth would undoubtedly have contributed to the increasingly commercial tone of the Celtic committee meetings after his departure. It has been argued that the absence of the Brother Superior's guiding influence led to a power struggle for the club's soul after 1892 until the year of 1897, which we mentioned, which saw the club incorporated as a limited liability company. Campbell and Woods conclude that the vacuum was filled by a lengthy debate surrounding the future of Celtic FC between what they termed the idealists, protective of the charitable legacy left behind by Walfrid, and opportunists in their book, who looked to expand commercially. So Willie Maley's account shows some insight into these episodes or these arguments around Brother Walfrid's original charitable aims. He records that £500 was promised by a committee man, though it was never received by the club, who was arguing that traditionalists would save the day and protect the ideals of Walfrid and Celtic from becoming a purely business venture. The debate, which happened in 1893, followed just 1 year after Walfrid departed for London, and it does indicate a groundswell of support for the charitable ethos instilled by Walfrid surrounding the club, and reflects the immediate legacy he left behind in Glasgow. Indeed, £10 of the 1893 donations were given personally to Brother Walfrid in tribute to his leading role in placing Celtic on its feet. This sum would have been gladly received by the Marist community here in London to aid their educational and charitable works. But clearly a crossroads had been reached in Glasgow as Celtic sought to strike a balance between business and the ideals of community and charity on which Walfrid helped to found the club. Kay and Vanplue cite Celtic as a prime example of the changing landscape of football in the wake of professionalisation. And I quote, they write that the decline in the club's charitable donations dates from 1893-94, the season, indeed, in which professionalism was formally adopted in Scottish football, end quote. Misgivings amongst prominent voices within Scottish football about the virtues of amateurism gradually gave way to widespread support for the clarity and equity that legalisation of player remuneration brought about. Indeed, the sport comments at the close of the 1894 season, and I quote, "Professionalism is now a year old and its birth has done a lot of good to Scottish football," end quote. And as I mentioned, one of Celtic's leading committee men, John Herbert McLaughlin, was really to the fore in terms of attempts to institute professionalism in Scotland. Writing retrospectively, of course, Handley characterised this period culminating in the incorporation of Celtic later in 1897 a decade after its beginnings as a charitable sporting endeavour, as a process where the ideals for the club, and his words in a quote, had been sicklied over with the pale cast of gold, end quote. Jerry McNee, on the other hand, in a centenary history of Celtic, summarised the process through which the club became a limited incorporation as one born of necessity. He finds that an emergency meeting of the business committee resolved to incorporate in March of 1897, in the same hall, indeed, that Walfred had created a club in the express purpose of charity. So Willie Mealy described the pressing need at the time to secure the club on a real business footing, in his words, and states that, and I quote, Celtic became such with a capital of £10,000, end quote. So effectively, incorporation protected the club's existence into the future, and that can go a long way to explaining the drift from its initial charitable impulse. In 1895, Brother Walfred himself reflected on the initial achievements of the Poor Children's Dinner Tables charity, which Celtic was brought into being to support. He wrote an article published by the Glasgow Observer from his new home in London, and it reads, and I quote, "In 1894, the good brothers of St Vincent de Paul opened the penny dinners for the school children, by which means the children were provided with a good, warm meal for a penny. Should parents prefer, they could send the bread and the soup could get a large bowl of broth or soup for half a penny. And those who were not able to pay got a substantial meal free. This has been a very great blessing to the poor children. The expenses for some time were met by subscriptions and collections, sermons, etc. Till the Celtic FC was started, the committee of which gave the brothers about 33 shillings a week, up to a short time since," end quote. So Walfred, as an individual, was evidently concerned with the physical, educational and spiritual well-being of the children under his care, particularly those most in need. This is reflected on a return visit to Glasgow in 1897, where he implores members of the Sacred Heart Young Men's Society to make good use of the books in the library and to pay attention to those, to the advice of those in charge. End quote. So Walfred's role in the establishment of Celtic FC will for many represent the culmination of a life's work. However, his service as a senior Marist brother, as we mentioned, was required in London, and it was there that Walfred continued to live out his religious vocation as a Marist. So works of charity and a passionate interest in football were two enduring hallmarks that were to continue in his life and work in London. So if I can just return to my slides, and I'll keep this brief. I'm conscious that I've spoke for quite a long time. I've only got a couple of slides to round off, but as I mentioned, Walfred was called away in 1892 by his religious superiors because a senior Marist brother was required for the City of London in 1892. So I've chosen a quotation, a reminiscence, reflecting on, and I quote, "We sustained a great loss by the departure of the Reverend Brother Walfred, who was founder and is still the honorary president of our society," and that's from the St. Vincent de Paul charitable branch that would have, you know, physically fed the children using the proceeds raised at the gate at Celtic Park. So he very clearly was a very influential figure in more ways than one. Excuse me. So second last slide, I promise. I've shared an image of a recent campaign that was run by the Celtic Football Club's own charitable foundation in recent times. This was during the COVID pandemic. There was an appeal put out. It was called Walfred's Wish. And on the left-hand side of the image, you see Victorian-era children being physically fed by Walfrid, juxtaposed with more modern figures on the right-hand side. So I find it significant that the football club often uses the image, quite literally, of its founder to evoke that idea of charity and to encourage individuals with an inclination towards the football club to engage in fundraising activities. So the image on the right shows the doors of the parish church that Walfrid was moved to here in London, St Anne's in the Whitechapel area, not far from Brick Lane in the east end of London. So I'm in there somewhere. I was lucky enough to go along to one of their charity sleepouts where you sleep overnight out in the elements. It was held in November a few years back during my PhD research, and by all accounts I think we got away with it. It wasn't too cold that night. But it's significant that the club uses sites and locations relevant to the life of Walfrid. It's perhaps why it's so surprising that it's taken so long for a reappraisal of his life to have taken place. But on that particular trip to St Anne's in the East End of London, I uncovered a handwritten note. So as you can imagine, handwritten primary source material was pretty difficult to come by, given the fact that almost over 100 years have passed since Walfrid died in 1915. So we found a short note, and I'll read it for you. "I regret that we were obliged to pay so much for clothes, but the poor children were so poorly clad that we could not do it for less." So that motif of concern for poor children, the most disadvantaged under his care, evidently endured as he moved down to continue his humanitarian work and educational work in London. That's from 1906, so nearly 20 years after he founded Celtic in Glasgow. So final slide, just to round off. I've repeated my last research question, which was, why is Walfrid important today? What is his relevance? What is his significance? And my research just led me to those enduring kind of golden threads that run through his life, that faith, that devotion to his religious vocation. So that would be faith, community, the charitable fundraising that he was able, as an individual, during his life to encourage, but also his memory now, even today, inspires people within the Celtic community to go out and do likewise. And finally, of course, the famous connection to the football club that he founded up in Glasgow. And also, just to round off, the quote, "We brothers are often very bad at identifying our own heroes." That was what a modern Marist brother told me at a conference in Rome back in December. A lot of the Marist brothers who were present, it was a very international conference with brothers from South America, Australia, North America. They'd all heard of Celtic Football Club and its success as a sports team, but they weren't aware that Walfrid was one of their own. He was a Marist brother who had actually founded the club in the first instance. So that was another interesting kind of detail, but I think I've spoken for long enough. So thanks for listening. Thank you.